Hello, lovely listeners. Before we get to the episode, we want to take a moment to address the June 24th, 2022 Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. This decision stripped away the right to have a safe and legal abortion. Everyone should have the freedom to decide what's best for themselves and for their families, including when it comes to ending a pregnancy. This decision has dire consequences for individual health and safety, and could have harsh repercussions for other landmark decisions. Restricting access to comprehensive reproductive care, including abortion, threatens the health and independence of all. Learn more by visiting choice.crd.co. That's choice.crd.co. If you're able to support others, please consider donating to abortion funds. We encourage you to speak up, take care, and spread the word. Baseball. It's America's favorite pastime. There's nothing like the rivalries between teams, the excitement of catching and keeping a ball. Nothing compares to going to your old ballpark on a sunny day, wearing your Dodgers jersey, having a hot dog, a cold beer, and cheering on your team. But have you ever stopped to wonder what used to be here before it became Dodger Stadium? What was destroyed so that you could drink, cheer, and root your favorite team? Hi everyone, this is Christina
and Carmen,
and this is Historias Unknown, formerly known as It Was Capitalism All Along. Yes, we are now Historias Unknown, and if you didn't hear my little announcement, we changed it so that we could cover a wider range of topics in addition to what we were already going to cover.
We thought it was a better fit. A lot of brainstorming and combination of things to see if it sounded right, and we settled on Historias Unknown, and I feel like it's pretty,
I like it, yeah,
pretty catchy, yeah.
But today I will be telling you, Carmen, and all of our listeners about the Battle of Chavez Ravine, or also known as the displacement of Mexican-American communities for the Dodger Stadium. How much do you know about this?
I know that it happened.
Okay, yeah.
And I remember, I think you told me about it as you're researching, but also I read about it before somewhere, about like the last house that stood. But that's about it.
When did you first hear about it?
I want to say it was when I started following, she used to be known as Chicanisma, but now
and Femwaves.
She is and Femwaves, yes. I started following her. I don't know. It was a long time ago.
So was it when you started college, I think?
Yeah.
You started getting into a lot of this.
I was radicalized.
Yes.
As they say. In college in UC Merced. Holla. I joined the feminist club there. Yeah. Anyway, that's when I followed. I found her. And I learned so much from her. And that was one of the things that I learned.
I just learned about this, like, I don't even know, a couple months ago when I was listening to Dark History, the Bailey Sarian podcast.
I actually didn't listen to that episode.
Yeah, she briefly mentions it because she also talks about another two parks that were Black communities that this happened to. But I had no idea it happened. And I feel like being from California, maybe it was something that we should have learned about.
Yeah, definitely. I know. So when I was at MJC, I took a history of California class. I don't think it talked like, I think it was history as in way, way long ago.
Okay.
When it was mainly indigenous. And I think until the Spanish colonized it, and then it became Mexico, and then United States stole it. I think that's how far the class got.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't learn about this at all. So yeah, that's why I wanted to cover it, because I'm sure maybe some people know, but I feel like the majority of people don't know still.
Yeah.
So before it was Los Angeles, it was home to the Tongva people, T-O-N-G-V-A.
You didn't Google it?
No, I'm sorry. I should have. Anyway, it was home to the Tongva people and the Chumash people. And then Spanish explorers arrived in 1542 and they claimed it.
And they started naming places like, this is Los Angeles, this is San Pedro, this is Santa Catalina Island. But then they left, and no one really lived there except the people that were already there, right? And then in 1771, they set up missionaries. And then 10 years later, the first Spanish settlers arrived. And they founded the town. Well, and this is all in quotations, founded, right? Because like it was already there. So they founded the town of El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora de la Reina de Los Ángeles.
Ay, Jesucristo. Dios mío, bebé, nativo de Jerusalén.
Why? But yeah, so this is what would be known as Los Angeles later.
It's just all those names. I felt like I needed to say everything.
You need to add more names. Understandable. And so, yeah, when Mexico won its independence from Spain, this area was then part of Mexico. And then by then it had grown in size. And then during the Mexican-American War, Americans took California from Mexico along with other land. And this is all like ignoring the fact that this was already the land right. of the Tonga and the Chumash people. Yes, that goes without saying. But yeah, I just needed to mention it again. So, yeah. So then before this occurred, though, in 1844, a Spanish man named Julian Chavez purchased 83 acres of land in Los Angeles. And this was later known as Chavez Ravine. It's named after him. And he was like a some sort of like prominent governor person of Los Angeles. And so he purchased those 83 acres of land. And this is where Dodger Stadium is now located. For a long time, this area was pretty uninhabited. Between the years 1850 and 1880, it was used as a pest house. And that is where they treat sick people with smallpox.
Oh, my mind went somewhere else, like pest house. I was like, mice.
So, yeah, it was a pest house that's where they treated people with smallpox. And there was a smallpox epidemic at this time. And
why didn't they call it pox house?
That would have been good. Wow. Right? They missed opportunity, really. And this pest house mostly cared for Mexican-American and Chinese-American patients. Later in the 1850s, it became a Jewish American neighborhood with a small Mexican American presence. It slowly grew, but during the Mexican Revolution, there was a huge migration from Mexico to the West Coast, mainly Arizona and then California. Entire pueblos from Mexico migrated together and they would settle in communities together, almost as if they had a little piece of their own country in these communities. Because The entire pueblos moved together, crossed the border together. I mean, it was not a border then. They just traveled. They could travel back and forth. And so, yeah, first.
Went north.
Yeah, they went north, but all together. Yeah, so which is like, so it was like, they just, it was still Mexico, basically, except not Mexico, right? But yeah. Yeah, so a lot of this little pueblo that was very close to Fresnillo, Zacatecas, found themselves first in Arizona. Together, they arrived at the Chavez Ravine area, and there was almost nothing there, so they built their homes from scratch. They laid the foundations, and brick by brick, they built their houses. Like
again. You know, it amazes me how people used to build stuff.
God, seriously, can you, like...
And do anything back then, yeah. I don't know.
They fled their war-torn country, moved to Arizona, then the work there was getting bad, so they moved to L.A. and literally built houses from scratch, like...
Yeah.
I could never.
I can't even paint. I'm over it.
This, y'all, she has been painting her house for years now. Weeks.
Yeah.
For a very long time.
It feels like it.
Every time I'm like, what are you doing this weekend? Painting.
I'm painting.
Okay, so... So then Chavez Ravine became a semi-rural Mexican community, and these neighborhoods were La Loma, Bishop, and Palo Verde, and by white American standards, they were an eyesore on Los Angeles. They were the slums. They were poor. But by their own standards, these three neighborhoods were thriving. They had their own local church, their elementary school, and they knew how to organize. They... they went to the city to finally give them electricity while because they were like one of the last neighborhoods to get electricity. They advocated for a park for their elementary school. It was a very progressive elementary school too, with a very good principal, and their church. I mean, it was a Catholic church, but it was like so everything about this place was so community oriented. Like, it was amazing to read about. But yeah, they were doing great. Like,
sounds like it.
Yeah, they were homeowners that had to build their own homes because they couldn't have houses in the rest of LA due to redlining.
Of course.
Yeah, if you don't know what redlining is, it's basically like very, very watered down. Like, they didn't give house loans to non-white people.
Yeah.
So while the people of La Loma, Bishop, and Palo Verde loved and advocated for their neighborhood, it was a stain on the city for everyone else. So unknown to the people of Chavez Ravine, there was a man. His name was Frank Wilkinson, and he worked for the Los Angeles Housing Authority. And his main thing was like finding places to create projects, public housing. That was his thing. And he like believed in his mission, right? Like, he even lived in the projects himself.
Wow.
Because that's how much he believed he was helping people with these public housings. And yeah, in some areas, it was probably helping. However, he truly believed that he had to get rid of this neighborhood that was like an eyesore in order to build public housing in this already existing community.
But people already had houses there?
Yeah.
Like, this was like they built their houses, right?
Yeah. They had built their own homes, but
he was like, your houses are trash. I can do you one better.
Basically, this guy, I'm not going to go too much into his history, but he was a communist. He joined the Communist Party in secret because it had to be a secret back then, right?
Yeah.
And he traveled to like another quote-unquote third world country and was appalled at how poor it was. And then he traveled to the Soviet Union and saw how like people were actually doing good. And so he returned and he would tell everyone that he knew, like, they were living in squalor. And then someone that he knew told him, you don't even have to travel to these places to like see people living in those same conditions. Oh. And that person took him to these neighborhoods. And that's when he was like, wow, this is disgusting. This is an eyesore. I need to help these people because they cannot help themselves. And so he to convince people that he the city needed public housing built there, he would take them to that neighborhood in buses. Like, it was like a bus tour.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, a whole bus tour for the slums is what he called it. And he would just take them there. And these were people's homes. Like,
I'm sorry. This just goes to show, like, the number one rule, I don't know, of, quote, helping a community is to ask the community what it needs. And if the community does not want public housing and is okay with the housing they already made for themselves, then mind your fucking business. Also, yes. Goes to show how people think they're doing good and they're actually doing harm.
Yes.
When they don't take culture
into account.
Yeah.
So this man, Frank Wilkinson, like, he was advocating to turn these three neighborhoods into the Elysian Park Heights. Elysian Park Heights would be a new public housing development. It was planned to take up 54 acres, and it would include 24 13-story buildings and 163 one-story buildings, which would provide 3,600 new low-cost apartments. But in order for Elysian Park Heights to happen, the neighborhoods of La Loma, Bishop, and Palo Verde would be destroyed. And like I already said, Frank Wilkinson believed this was necessary. And this was his idea of ridding LA of poverty and helping people. So, yeah, he would take developers, investors, people that needed convincing about Elysian Park Heights on bus tours so they could see the appalling slums where people were living, like, which we already said that, but, like, wow. So, in 1951, Frank Wilkinson and the Los Angeles Housing Authority were able to slate the Chavez Ravine neighborhoods for redevelopment, and they sent official letters to the residents of these neighborhoods. And many of the people of Chavez Ravine could not read English. Some of them couldn't read Spanish either. So when they were checking their mail, they could see, like, this is an official letter from Los Angeles. So some of them called their own children to translate. And just the trauma, can you, I mean, if that would have been our family, that would have been us translating, like, you know?
Like, oh my God, they're going to destroy our house.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And this is the moment they learned that their homes were to be torn down for the Elysian Park Heights, a new housing complex. But worry not, because they could apply first to live in this complex, according to the letter that they received. However, many of the people of La Loma, Bishop, and Palo Verde were not eligible to even apply to live in Elysian Park because they were undocumented.
Oh my God.
So, like, Frank Wilkinson believed that they were all going to live in this new apartment complex anyway, so it wasn't a big deal to tear down their houses and give them somewhere better to live.
I'm sorry, did he even look at the requirements of the public housing and to see if that community was even eligible?
No, because he didn't care. Like, not the majority. Yeah, the majority could not even apply because they were undocumented. And they also had, like, they had their own gardens where that they all shared. They had livestock. A lot of them had chickens, goats, that they all, like, would cook and just, it was, like, such a community-oriented neighborhood. So how can you have that with these giant apartments? You can't.
And if he's supposedly a communist, how does that, it sounds like he's destroying something that was more
communist
than, and then to put up apartments that would destroy the community-minded environment that they had already built
for themselves.
Ridiculous.
He truly believed he was doing good here.
Sounds about white.
Yes, very. So before I continue with this, let me explain how this is even legal, because it is legal. So the city and, like, cities, how can they just determine, like, this neighborhood's too poor and we're going to get rid of it to build something? So this is legal thanks to the National Housing Act of 1949, which gave states federal money for public housing. This act, Chavez Ravine was slated for redevelopment, and the Los Angeles Housing Authority began to collect land in 1951. This is all possible because of eminent domain. And eminent domain is the government's right to take private property for public use if they compensate the property owners.
So in one of my social work classes, we watched this documentary of, oh my God, I wish I remembered where the place was. I want to say it was somewhere in New York. But there was this community that they ended up taking back their own, like, houses that are being foreclosed and all, like, all this property using that same law.
Oh my God.
So they turned it over on its head and use it against the government.
That's beautiful. That is beautiful, especially because Central Park was another place where a Black community was destroyed to create Central Park using eminent domain. So that is amazing to hear. Wow. But that was not the case here, sadly, because, I mean, this was just created, and, yeah, this is just one of the many places that the government did this. Ugh, it's just gross to think about.
Yeah.
Oh, and again, if they compensated property owners, but for many of these people, they were being lowballed, like.
That's what usually happens, yeah.
So, back to Chavez Ravine. So when the people saw this letter, they refused to accept it. Frank Wilkinson went door to door with one of his Mexican-American employees to translate for him. And Frank Wilkinson had the audacity to be shocked when people were closing doors on him, kicking them out of his house, out of their homes, not wanting to take this deal. Because, again, he truly believed he was doing good. Like, and so he was like, I can't believe that they don't want to do this. Like, really? This is their home. Like, what do you mean?
And he probably thought that he was even better than them when
probably
they didn't want his help. Yeah. Uh-huh. He's like, oh, I know better. And that kind of attitude.
Yeah. And the problem with these kind of, like, I don't know, projects or people, even, they don't take into account, like, again, the community that's already there, but these people had to move, like, they fled Mexico, then they left Arizona altogether. And so this is their third home. And you think they want to leave again? No.
It screams white saviorism.
Yeah, it does. White saviorism. So as time passed, many did end up taking the offers, especially because the government began to lower offers. And they were telling them, these offers are only going to get lower and lower.
Yeah, they thought they had no choice.
They were seeing, like, the offers go down and down. And they were like, eventually you're going to get nothing and you're not going to have your house. Like, so a lot of them did, you know, pack up and take the offer. And the offers, they were low. The community grew smaller and smaller, and some families held out, including the Arechiga family and the Montalvo family. So this was, and I already said this, but this was their home. They didn't want to migrate again, right? This was, you know, this was their home and their houses. They built these houses themselves with their own two hands. So eventually the city abandoned the Elysian Park Heights project because building in that terrain was very difficult because it was a mountainous region. Like,
so then they couldn't even do it.
Yeah. So it was a ravine, and inside the ravine was the neighborhoods. But, like, building more than what was already there, it was just going to be very difficult. And on top of that, there was a very, it was during the Red Scare. And so a new governor of LA was, elected. And then he was, like, very anti-public housing. And so then there was, like, a whole hearing about it. And during the hearing, Frank Wilkinson was outed as a card-carrying communist and was imprisoned.
Why would he carry a card? Was that actually a thing, or was that a thing made up by...
Well, he burned the card. People would join the Communist Party and then burn their cards so they wouldn't be discovered. But since he was under oath and he was asked, like, what clubs are you a part of in your entire life? Can you name what clubs you have joined? And so he started with, like, I don't know, Boy Scouts. And that, I made that up. But, like, he starts naming different ones. And eventually he has to admit he is a part of the Communist Party. And so he's arrested. And then the project is killed. Like, it's like, yeah, this isn't happening because of the anti-communist sentiments. So, Chavez Ravine, obviously, they're going to think, hey, our houses are safe now because this project isn't happening anymore, right? And by then, La Loma, Palo Verde, and Bishop were almost a ghost town. It was no longer a home to 300-plus families.
So they had already destroyed the community already. Yes.
And only about 20 families remained at this time. The LA City Council tried to cancel the public housing contract, but the federal government did not allow it. And the new mayor that was elected in 1953 had already promised to get rid of housing projects and other un-American projects, is what he called them. He was able to buy the land back from the federal government, but because it was up for sale, it had to be used for public land again. So LA was already on the hunt for a major sports team to a house, like, as their own. And they were looking at the Brooklyn Dodgers. The Dodgers owner, his name was Walter O'Malley. And
I know so little about baseball that I had no idea they were ever Brooklyn Dodgers.
Really? Okay. Actually, me neither. Yeah. The history of the baseball leagues, it's pretty fascinating. Just how many teams jumped around and traveled. They were originally in Brooklyn. And LA was looking for a sports team. Walter O'Malley was looking to move the Brooklyn Dodgers anyway. So, wow, what a perfect deal for the both of them, right? So he agreed that he would purchase this land and move the Brooklyn Dodgers, but it had to be used for the stadium. And he purchased the land at a fraction of the price of what the Public Housing Authority had spent to build the Elysian Park Heights. So on May 8th, 1958, the city approved the referendum that would officially give Walter O'Malley ownership of the land. The next day, police arrived to evict the remaining families, and among them were the Arechigas, the Martins, and the Montalvos. So the book that I used for a lot of this, not even I, like, honestly, everyone, this is, was a, such a fascinating book because the way it's written, it starts with, like, the history of how the Arechiga family even arrived to L.A., and then they also started with how Frank Wilkinson went and arrived in L.A. and Walter O'Malley. And by the end, they combine all three stories. But it's not written like a history book. It's like, it's just such a fact. Like, I don't.
It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I know nothing about baseball. They also talk about a bit about the history of baseball along with it. And it was such a fascinating read. So I highly recommend it. And I only mentioned tiny portions of it. So it's, yeah, definitely worth, like, getting just to get the whole picture. But so the book Stealing Home is what it's called. It mentions that neighbors on that morning called each other and asked, because the families knew that the police was going to arrive, and so they called each other like, what are you going to do when the sheriffs arrive? And they were like, lock the doors. And on the morning of May 9th, journalists flooded the neighborhood along with police and construction crews. So when police arrived, the Arechiga family had nailed their door shut, rightfully so. And then there's like a very short 2-minute video that you can see all this happening. And there's also pictures. Deputies can be seen walking up to the home, trying to convince Avrana Arechiga. She's the matriarch of the family. She was 66 at the time this happened. So they try to convince Avrana Arechiga to leave peacefully, but it doesn't happen. They kick the door open, but because it was nailed shut, they have to kick several times to get in. You can see police break the windows so that they can take out all of the furniture faster because the Arechigas are trying to block the door still.
Oh my gosh.
One by one, you can see the police drag the family out. One of the Arechiga, one of Avrana's daughters is Tolina Arechiga, and they're trying to wrestle like a 9-month-old baby from her arms. Her 9-year-old daughter tries to block them. And Tolina is a widow. Her husband was killed in World War II.
Oh my, because that's a whole other subject.
Yes, that is a whole other subject. The amount of Mexican Americans that felt like they needed to serve their country in World War II. Is insane. Like, that actually, I'm gonna add that to the topic list
because I never knew that. Actually,
I didn't know that until I read this book because in the book they mentioned that so many kids were first generation here. Their parents had literally just gotten here, then the war broke out, and like every, you know, this, I mean, that, I feel like,
sorry, I was gonna say, now that I think about it, I think that like Paul's grandpa must have been first generation here, and he, I think, was like the first one that served in the military.
Yes, and in this community there was a Mexican journalist who truly believed to prove themselves American enough, Mexicans had to serve, and he was writing
I have heard about this.
Yeah, actually. He was writing in newspapers pushing for this, and that's why so many people joined. And there's even a group of mothers who would send letters. I don't know if you've heard about them. They deserve their own episode, too. A group of Mexican mothers that were, like, they created this whole system to mail letters to their children that were serving their sons. So, yeah, that's a whole nother topic. But she is the wife of a man.
It's just so unfortunate. It's not even, it doesn't even capture, like.
Yeah, a widow, her husband died in service, and this is happening to her, like.
Yeah. It's like, for what, bitch? For what?
Yeah.
And bitch as in the United States, not her.
Yeah, of course. So she is dragged out of the house by 4 police officers holding onto each of her limbs. And if you've ever seen pictures, this is one of the most famous pictures of this day, is her being dragged out in this manner. At the same time, across the street, the Vargas family is also being dragged out of their home. They're all dragged and cuffed in a little, like, lot in the neighborhood. Then they're placed into the car. They were given lunches that they refused to eat.
Of course. What the fuck?
Yeah. They actually threw another one, Lola Vargas, she threw her lunch out of the police car, and then she was arrested. And, well, I'm going to get into her story in a little bit, too. But, so, yeah, they were all dragged and cuffed out. They put into police cars. Abrana Arechiga, she was throwing rocks and yelling and crying in Spanish. Like, why don't they play ball in Mayor Paulson's backyard? This is the new mayor that, like, approved all this. Mm-hmm. But eventually she, too, is removed. The families watch as their home is bulldozed multiple times.
Oh, my God. Like, okay, so as you were explaining all this, I'm like, I can't imagine watching as you, family, your neighbors, your friends, your loved ones are being literally pushed out, grabbed, like, attacked.
Yeah.
To get out of your home and then to see all of your belongings. And, like, yeah, sure, things are just things, but things are not just things when you're an immigrant who left your country. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I heard this and I cried.
I'm about to cry right now.
Yeah, and then I was writing the notes and I was like, oh my God, I'm crying.
It's
disgusting.
It's just, like, so much anger. Now, like, as you were describing all of it, I felt like chills, of anger.
Yes. No, I know
exactly
what you're talking about. Yeah.
It's just so fucking disgusting.
It is. Yeah.
To even, like, and just horrifying to know this happened and it happens.
Yeah. And so Lola Vargas, the person who had thrown out her lunch from the police car, she was fined and jailed for resistance. The family, they attempted to hold out even after their house was bulldozed. They camped out in their former home for a while. But first, let me just go on to this little thing I wrote. The pictures are, like, very hard to look at, especially after, like, reading what happened. And there's footage of this. It's also very difficult to watch. But after their eviction, the Arechiga family, they were painted as... First, when all of it happened, they were, like, painted as victims. And people, like, rallied around them. But then they were painted as attention seekers that were not really poor because someone leaked that they owned 11 homes. But this was a lie because when you think about it, the oldest, the patriarchs of the family, right, and the matriarch of the family, they're the grandparents. Their children went on to own homes and their cousins because... So there was a lot of Arechigas. It wasn't just them. And among this wide extended family, yeah.
So they're trying to say all the houses were...
Yes, were theirs. And they were just greedy-ass Mexicans that refused to give up this house. But this was the house...
First of all, even if they had a lot of houses, anyone who was forcibly... Except, unless it's like a landlord situation or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But anyway. Why would they want to forcibly... Who?
Yeah.
Who in their right mind? Like, what?
Yeah, exactly. So Abrana and Manuel, even with all this negative information being put out, that was not true at all. They refused to leave. First, they were in a tent, and then people rallied and got them an RV. And they were in an RV in their former house. It was just a lot by then. Everything else was gone. Then there was hearings held about the evictions. And during the hearing... The Arechiga family, they could no longer, like, demand to have their home back because it was bulldozed to the ground, right? So then they were just demanding to be compensated for the house they lost. They wanted the original offer, and the city did not want to pay that original offer. And the city's argument was like, well, if we rule in the favor of the Arechigas, chaos will ensue, and thousands will refuse to leave when orders, like the eviction order of the Arechigas, are trying to be carried out, people are going to...
How about y'all stop evicting people? What the fuck?
Seriously, yeah.
How is that even a valid argument?
That was their argument. Eventually, the Arechigas, they put up a long fight, but they had no choice. And they accepted the city's offer of $10,500, which was still less than what the house was worth. But
yeah,
that compared to nothing, you know?
And at some point, the thing when people, like, face governments and face, corporations and whatnot, is that these corporations and governments have so much more financial backing and power that they don't get tired of fighting, but people do.
Yeah. At some point, you have to move on. because you have no choice. But so that's what they did. This was what did I say? 1958? Yeah, 1958. So on April 10th, 1962, the Dodger Stadium finally opened, like officially opened. Thousands flocked to watch the game and admire the new stadium. The families that were removed and the homes that were once there were long forgotten, forgotten to all except the people that were removed, the people that were directly affected by this. They seem to be the only ones still care that this happened, as per usual, right? So I found one article that they interview Vicente Montalvo, whose grandfather and grandmother had been one of the last people to leave the neighborhood, one of the people that were evicted on that day. And he said that in the 80s, his own father had taken him to a Dodgers game. So his mom was the Montalvo. His dad was a Mexican immigrant. And if you go back to the 1980s, Fernando Valenzuela was the Dodgers pitcher, and he was Mexican. And so many Mexican and Mexican-American people were behind him, obviously, yeah. Because who isn't in it, like, any sport? If someone from Mexico, like, you're going to rally behind that team, especially if it's your neighborhood. So if you look at the Dodgers and the makeup of Dodgers fans, about half of them are Latino, and then most of those are Mexican-Americans or Mexicans.
I mean, when I think about the Dodgers, I think about Mexicans.
Same. And I think about our cousins sporting their L.A. Dodgers. Yes.
Yeah, their gear and stuff. Hats and
gear, yeah.
Yeah.
And especially if they're from the area, because you're going to support whatever team you live in, you know, you're going to support that team automatically. But with the Dodgers, it's like a whole new thing, you know. But especially in the 1980s. And there's actually a documentary about Fernando Valenzuela that's called Fernando Mania, because, like, people really rallied behind him. So, and one of these people, it was, what was his name? Hold on. Vicente Montalvo, his dad, who was a Mexican immigrant. He was all for it. So he took him to the game. And Vicente Montalvo says that his grandfather didn't speak to his father for 20 years, taking him to the game, because he was still so affected by what happened that day.
I could totally see it, though. It's just a hard situation all around, because, of course, he is going to still be angry about that. And then, yeah, I would get angry at my son. Like, how dare you fucking go there to the place that displays stuff?
Yeah.
But then I could also see it from son's point of view about, like, wanting to support.
No, it's the son-in-law to the grandfather.
Oh, the son-in-law. Yes. Well, fuck that son-in-law then.
But, like, at the same time, he was a Mexican immigrant who wanted to support this Mexican
player. That's what I'm saying. Like, I understand. wanting to support a Mexican-American on the team. Probably the first time,
not Mexican-American. Mexican.
Oh, straight up Mexican. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. And it was the first Mexican on the Dodgers, right?
Yeah.
Or did I just make that? Okay.
I think it was.
So, yeah. Probably if so much people rallied behind him like that. So I understand, like, both feelings behind this.
Yeah.
I think in the end, it also goes to show that there is no ethical conception under
No ethical conception of what?
Under capitalism. Oh, because here, this person is just wanting to support and rally behind someone of his own ethnicity. But to support him and that team means to support and stand behind the displacement of Mexicans in the community. Yeah, like, exactly. Fuck.
And so many of these families, Vicente Montalvo, he says, like, all my grandfather talked about was Palo Verde. Like, oh, if something happened, oh, in Palo Verde, we did it better. Because it was a thriving community.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah, they probably did. Like, their school, even though it was so low income, was, like, there for the kids. And it was just, honestly, you should read the book, because they go into how the community was doing. So I wish I could just, like, give it to you, because I'm done reading it, but it's through Audible.
You know why you can?
Capitalism.
Capitalism.
Yeah. But, the grandfather would just always bring up Palo Verde. the other families, they did not talk about the Dodgers. They hated the Dodgers. They did not go to the games. And they would, like him, they would disown family members for going to the games. And I can totally see that because, like, honestly, I don't want to generalize Latino people, but we will disown people even, or I mean, we don't talk about Bruno, right? Like, no, we don't talk about the Dodgers.
There's a reason that song was written.
Yeah.
And why it's one of the most popular from the movie. It's because
everyone has a Bruno.
In every family. Oh my God. No, well, so when you were saying that the some of the families didn't talk about the Dodgers, and like, it reminded me of the book I'm reading now about Coca-Cola and how the workers who were, I don't know, their spirits were destroyed by Coca-Cola and its franchisees and bottling companies, blah, blah, blah. And they don't drink Coke.
Understandable. And so Valenzuela, in the documentary, Fernando Mania, he mentions that he never heard about Mexican families being forced out of their homes for the Dodgers and the Dodgers stadium. He said that it was not talked about. Like, it was like almost hidden. Like, nobody talked about it. And I also found a video of Avrana Arechiga's great granddaughter, Melissa Arechiga. And she's talking about how she couldn't believe, she grew up in LA and she couldn't believe that this was not talked about in school. Like, she knew about it because her mother made sure to tell her, like, this is our history. We were displaced for this stadium. Like, so that's why she knew about it. And she says, like, I almost didn't believe my mom because, like, it just wasn't mentioned anywhere else. So I was like, she's making this up.
You're like, if it's true, I would know about it. I would learn about it, right?
Somewhere else. Yeah, I would hear about it. And so then she attends UCLA, and in her understudies, she takes Chicano studies. And this,
of course,
is the first place that she hears about this happening in an academic setting, and the first time that she sees the pictures of her own family being moved and, like, literally dragged out of their homes. Like, can you imagine?
And, like, I'm sorry, but the first time that people learn about this, or that people learn about their own cultures, should not be in freaking college when you're fucking 18 already, like, or older.
And then,
you know?
Sadly, it's usually Chicano studies, which in it of itself, yes, is problematic.
Right.
It has, like, problematic parts of it. And they're the only ones talking about these things. So then people become Chicanos, and then they envelop these same problematic views.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel like maybe that should be its own episode, but not because it would take forever to even dive into how problematic it is. But they are the only ones talking about this kind of stuff, which is why I didn't hear half of this shit, because I never took a course that was, like, focused on this stuff. But Melissa Arechiga, along with Vicente Montalvo and one other person that I forgot, they formed an organization called Buried Under Blue. And with this, they're striving to keep the history of La Loma Bishop and Palo Verde alive.
Saying, I've never heard of that either.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah, and I found the website. And yeah, it's, they go places, they talk about what happened. They give interviews, which is how I found those clips of them saying, talking about the stuff. But, like, that's beautiful, but also traumatizing that you're like, but we see it so much with Latine,
yes,
children, just you, you, yeah. Like, when the immigrant daughter becomes, or the child of immigrants becomes an immigrant lawyer, right? Or things like that. Like,
yes.
But yeah, that is what I have on the Battle of Chavez Ravine, which not enough people know about.
It's hard to learn about all of this, but it's also, I don't know. I mean, of course, I don't want to romanticize, like, trauma and whatnot, but it's also, like, amazing to hear, like, of the strong community that, you know, thrive there, and just, like, how community oriented like Mexican community is, right? And how, I don't know, it's kind of all fallen to shit for so many people because like now people don't live there near their families.
Oh yeah.
Well, immigration, of course, changes all of that. And it's hard out here.
It really is. My little baby's out there crying, so this is a good place to end the episode. Well, I don't want to say I hope you enjoyed it, but I hope that you learned something you didn't know. Even if you knew about the story before, like maybe I provided some details that you didn't know before, which is what I, because I knew about it before, but I didn't, like you, I didn't know the extent of it.
Yeah.
So next episode, Carmen's going to be talking about Coca-Cola.
Yes. Let me preface this by saying, fuck Coca-Cola. I never drink Coca-Cola again, which I don't really
even, I don't
really
even like Coca-Cola. It. They can suck it. No, I don't like, I don't drink a lot of soda anyway.
No, me either. But the hold that Coca-Cola has on the Latina community,
I'm actually, is real. I have it on the topic list, Coca-Cola in Mexico specifically. It's,
yeah, disgusting.
Thanks for listening. We will catch everyone next time. And if you want lighter episodes from us that are funny, I think funny, check out the Patreon where we will cover Am I the Asshole stories or Reddit stories that involve money. Maybe we'll do like short unknown history if I can find something nicer and lighter than...
Yeah, it's got to be something out there.
There's got to be good unknown Latin American history out there.
Yeah. You know what, actually? Well, I guess I can talk about it later since Sammy is crying.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for listening. And we don't have a tagline, so.
Goodbye for now until we think of one.
Yes. Bye.
Bye.
Sources for this episode include Stealing Home, Los Angeles, The Dodgers, and The Lives Caught in Between by Eric Nussbaum, a Medium article titled The Three Chicano Communities Buried Under Dodger Stadium, a Wikipedia entry for Battle of Travis Ravine, an NPR article titled Remembering the Communities Buried Under Center Field, and an article from zinproject.org/Travis Ravine. Historias Unknown is hosted by Carmen and Christina, produced by Christina, edited by Christina, and researched by both Carmen and Christina. If you like what you listen to, then please consider giving us a 5-star rating or tell your baseball-loving friend about this episode specifically. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye.